Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP. Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by my firm, Herity & Herity, the go-to firm for the PAN 300 for PAN preparation and prosecution. I'm Eli Mazur, and today we're lucky to be joined by former USPTO Director Andre Iancu. At the beginning of this year, former Deputy USPTO Director Russ Slifer wrote, "Director Iancu did not shy away from necessary reforms in Section 101 and the PTAP. Will the next director be as successful? Hopefully. But Director Iancu is a difficult act to follow." Thank you so much for joining.
My pleasure, Eli, and an honor to be with you. And thank you for that very kind introduction.
So I usually jump right into patents, but you actually have a similar life story to mine. You immigrated from communist Romania when you were 13. Can you tell us a little bit about what your family thought about America before you came here? And I guess, how did that impact you?
Sure. So just a couple of months ago marked my 40th year in the United States. Yeah, it's remarkable how time flies. But my father wanted to leave communist Romania since the mid-50s. And, you know, it took him basically 25 years to be able to figure out how to go, how to get out. You know, he always wanted to come to the United States. We had, and back then, and we have now, family in Israel. We had family and friends in Europe and elsewhere around the world. But, you know, sight unseen, like so many people around the world, my parents always dreamt of coming here to the United States. So finally, at the end of 1980, we were able to get out, spent the winter in Rome, Italy, which was typical for political refugees from the communist bloc at that time. And then in February 1981, we were able to get to the United States.
Do you know what about America particularly attracted to him?
I think it's the typical immigrant story and immigrant dream, the freedom that this country offers and everybody around the world dreams of, and the opportunities for the next generations to help themselves and do better than the prior generation. So this is the promise of America. And as it turns out, Eli, as you know, I'm sure, and folks listening, for me, the pull of this country is true. And I think what this country offers in terms of freedom and opportunity to this day, no matter the difficulties and all the turmoil of any given day, still is the best place to be for freedom and opportunity anywhere in the world and at any time in history.
That's definitely true. Can you talk a little bit about how it specifically, I guess, influenced your view of the role of government and patent rights? Did that kind of impact coming from a communist country to here? Do you ever think about that?
That's interesting. No, I actually don't think I have thought about it in those terms. You know, as you know, I'm a huge fan of innovation and creation, creativity, and the intellectual property that supports all of that. I do believe in one's ability to take control of their own destiny and succeed. And I think the United States offers that, unlike any other country, you know, and perhaps my background does help me form that view. But to be frank, I'm not the only one, obviously, who has that view. Lots of people who were not immigrants in the first or even second generation still have that view. But I will say that I do think this country is uniquely equipped for innovation and creativity and strong intellectual property rights. It's not a coincidence that this has all happened here. This is a place where there is freedom to try anything and freedom to pull yourselves up by the bootstraps and freedom to succeed and, frankly, even freedom to fail. Those are key ingredients to innovation and creativity. And it's flourished here because of that. So other countries, especially repressive regimes, don't have that. And I think it's a unique advantage for the United States.
My normal opening question is, do you remember when you first learned about patents?
Actually, it was when I was an engineer at Hughes Aircraft. We came up with a new technology at Hughes that was called the shaped reflector. And it ultimately turned out to be a foundational technology for direct broadcasting of satellite TV and other such things. And I was the mechanical engineer. So I worked on that antenna system that was the satellite antenna system. And we came up with a lot of new things. So back then I was, you know, a young engineer and I didn't know much about anything, but I was talking to counsel at the time, and they said, well, we're debating, should we get patents on this or should we just keep it as a trade secret, whatever. So that's the first time I encountered IP in general. By the way, we did not apply for patents. It was a company's decision. I didn't know anything. So, but anyway, so that was then. And then after engineering school, I went on to be an engineer. I had a very good friend from engineering school, but he went on to go to law school. And then he graduated and he became a patent lawyer. So I spoke to him quite a bit about his experience, and ultimately I ended up going to law school as a result.
So you started your patent litigation career at Lion & Lion, and then you obviously became a managing partner of Ireland and Manila, where you represented clients on quote-unquote both sides of the V. What was your impression of how the patent system was working, and did you think anybody had a fair or an unfair advantage when you represented the clients on both sides?
Yeah, so for 20 years or so, I represented clients on both sides and all sorts of industries. You know, I've done a lot of work with medical devices, biotech, high-tech stuff, internet. So basically across the board, big companies, small companies, and everything in between. You know, for the as a general principle, if I look back for the past 20 years or so, you know, there's always, you know, what they say, the pendulum swinging from one side to the other. But overall, in the grand scheme of things, I thought that, and I think now that generally the system is fairly well balanced. You know, towards the middle of the last decade, you know, and coming up to my joining the USPTO, I began to think that the system was beginning to be unbalanced. I thought that the proverbial pendulum had swung too far in one direction. And that's not good for anyone, obviously, and certainly not good for the United States in innovation. You really do want to try as best as you can to have a balanced system. But anyway, so there was a period of time a few years ago when I thought that more can be done to bring a bit some more balance.
And I remember when you first became USPTO director, you told a story. I think you were maybe vacationing in Europe, and you told somebody about your line of work, and the first thing they said was, "Oh, I know what that is, patent trolls," or something along those lines. I think you said the pendulum swung too far, but how do you think America got to that point where people most associated with the patent, a lot of people associated with the patent system was quote unquote patent trolls?
Yeah, well, look, it was a period of number of years of repeated and constant public discourse that was on balance against patents and the value of patents in the United States and for the U.S. economy. You remember well the story. I haven't talked about it in some time, but it's true. It wasn't in Europe. I was skiing in Alaska, actually.
Okay.
I was taking a ski lift, and I was actually with a stranger on that lift, somebody I had never met before that lift ride. And as you know, you have 5-10 minutes of, you know, quiet time riding up, and sometimes you chit chat. So, you know, I asked him, what do you do? So he asked me what I do. And I said, I'm a patent lawyer. So literally on the left, he says, first thing he says, ah, patent trolls. What should we do about patent trolls? So it's true. And that was one of the, it really was an aha moment for me. And I thought, how sad is that? And how detrimental to the United States if that is the story that most people associate with our IP system. Because really, wouldn't we be much better off if the first reaction is, patents, Thomas Edison, the Wright brothers, right? Steve Jobs, yeah. Whatever. You know, some great inventors and inspirational stories which the patent system has enabled for all these years. And to have lost that narrative was consequential in my thinking about the U.S. patent system. And I did want to do something about it. And you might recall, Eli, that when I first joined the PTO and I was giving early remarks, I had focused on three things primarily. Obviously, there was a lot to do. There still is, always is. But I focused on three major things. And one of the three was to change the narrative in the United States when it comes to patents and intellectual property in general, to focus on the brilliance of inventors, the incredible benefits of the IP system that supports them, and the great benefits they all bring to the United States economy and just the well-being of humanity in general. You know, obviously, if there are abuses in the system, then we need to address them like with anything else and try to eliminate them as efficiently as possible. But for any successful system, you got to think about and focus on its benefits, its goals, its aspirations, and work towards those. So changing that narrative was really important for me. I think we've done that to some extent in the past 3-4 years. There's continuous work that needs to be done on this because the pressures, both domestic and international, against American intellectual property are continuing and continuous. So we have to continuously advocate for the great system that we have.
Yeah, and I think that definitely stood out. I think you began almost every speech talking about a great American innovator. So even for a patent attorney, it was very educational and kind of invigorating to hear that. So I think people within and outside the IP system definitely noticed. It's funny. I mean, one of the things that you said during your confirmation hearing was, it is no accident that all great innovation in America happened on American soil and within the context of a constitution that recognizes the importance of IP rights. And obviously you said that before the pandemic ever happened, before the miracle of the COVID vaccines ever happened and that kind of in record time, the development and all that. I mean, what kind of impact do you think that will have on the perception of the patent system or IP rights? Because now you kind of see arguments from both sides. Some seeing, well, IP rights are actually the obstacle to providing vaccines and so forth. I guess, how do you think that will play out, or how do you think it should play out?
Well, it's a very good question, and we're in the middle of that public debate right now. And it's really important to keep highlighting how successful the IP system has been and innovation has been in order to address the pandemic. Think about it. Within a year of COVID-19 reaching our shores, we had not just invented and developed and produced, but also approved for clinical use, not just one vaccine, but multiple vaccines. And not just any kind of vaccine, not a vaccine that works like other vaccines and is got an efficacy of about 50-60%. These are vaccines of unbelievable efficacy so far, at least as we can tell from the scientific data, of 80-90+% success rates. It's remarkable how quickly this was done. And again, it's not a coincidence. It didn't just happen. It didn't just, you know, out of the blue, people said, oh, here's a new disease. We're going to go invent it overnight. This is based on years and decades of innovation and improvements that were able to be turned and utilized and put to use immediately upon the discovery of this new disease, of this new virus. So, folks who are criticizing and saying IP or whatever has stood in the way or are standing in the way or acting as a barrier, I say, where's the evidence? On what's your basis for saying that? There is no other example in history where technology in medical space has worked so well to deliver so much progress in such a short period of time to save human lives. By the way, as of this recording, as we're speaking right now, the United States has delivered more than 200 million doses of vaccines in the United States. Around the globe, approximately 1 billion so far doses of vaccines. And by the end of this calendar year, we're on track to reach 10 billion doses around the globe, enough to vaccinate the entire currently eligible population in the world. This is remarkable progress. So not only did we develop these vaccines, but the intellectual property system currently is allowing hundreds of domestic and international collaborations to manufacture and distribute these vaccines, both domestically and internationally. Johnson & Johnson, for example, partnering with Merck, Novartis and others helping Pfizer expand its manufacturing capabilities. This is incredible, right? So these major traditional competitors working with each other. AstraZeneca licensing the Serum Institute in India to create in India over 1 billion doses of vaccine, second only to the United States through these licensing arrangements. So when folks are saying that the IP system is not working, I say, where is the evidence?
Yeah, I think that's pretty compelling. You can't argue with that evidence, at least I don't know of any evidence that's been presented to kind of contradict that. I guess, how do you think that debate will play out?
Let's see what happens. But there are always voices out there, both domestic and international, unfortunately, that press against IP rights. Now, at the high level, the intentions are good. Everybody agrees. I certainly agree. And I'm sure you and everybody in the audience agrees. We want to create as many vaccines, manufacture as many vaccine doses as possible, as quickly as possible, and distribute them around the globe as equitably and as quickly as possible. So the goals for everyone are certainly, as a general principle at the high level, admirable. The only question is, what is the correct approach? What are the right mechanisms? So I believe that our IP system is currently formulated. I mean, strong, reliable IP rights around the globe pursuant to international treaties. It has worked well and is working well right now. And I would be very concerned about disturbing that because it's very risky. Eli, it's sort of like the way I think about this is like, okay, I'm driving in my car to my destination. I'm making really good progress. I am where I'm supposed to be along the way. And I'm in the middle of it complaining that the wheels on the car are hampering my progress. So what's my alternative? And what's the evidence that the alternative would work? But there is the other argument, obviously the other side, that also wants the same result of more vaccines distributed to more people around the world. They believe that if you vitiate IP rights around the world for this once in a century pandemic, we could do this even better, even faster. So my only point to that is it's fine to have the debate, but we better be really careful because it's working right now. And there is no evidence that what they're proposing would work at all. Where is it going to end? I don't know, but I'm really hoping that reasonable minds will prevail and will make decisions only based on the evidence at hand and not disturb the world's intellectual property systems.
So I think one of the, you mentioned that by the time you became USPTO director, you thought that the IP system, the patent system was a little bit out of balance. And I think one of the reasons for that was really the creation of the PTAB. Did you think it was more of a perception issue, or do you think it was really, it was unfair in the way it operated because of the way it was set up and the rules that I guess, some of which you changed?
Yeah, so look, it's a very good question, Eli. I actually think it's both. It was both. I think that there were real issues that caused the PTAB to be out of balance, but there was also a major perception issue caused by a series of implementation approaches in the early days that took some time to work themselves out through the system. And, you know, the perception was potentially was negative and damaging for any legal system, any adjudicatory body. You obviously want fairness, want balance in reality, but also perception is key. Parties that approach any judicial body need to feel that they're getting a fair shake. And you know, at the end of the day, win or lose, you need to say, I think I was treated fairly on balance, yeah. You know? And I think that was a problem a few years ago. So I did try to correct as best as possible.
And out of all the changes, I think, that happened to kind of bring balance to that PTAB process, which one do you think was the most beneficial?
I think you got to look at them together as a package. I don't know that I can single any one particular out, but, you know, for example, the claim construction standard, making it the same as in district court, I think that was an important change. A more robust amendment system, that is what the statute intended, to have the ability to amend. So now we actually, for the first time, do have a practical way to amend. So we see the numbers reflecting that. So I think that was important. A number of different changes that collectively address multiple petitions. You know, the PTAB was meant to have this balance, right? From the inception, you know, you look at this legislative history, was very clear that the PTAB is meant to be an alternative, cheaper, faster to district court litigation. And it was not meant to be multiple bites at the apple, repeated and never-ending attacks on the same asset and the like. So we did a number of things to address those things. So collectively, I think that's been successful. Really important was the question of transparency, how judges are assigned to the panels. You might recall, nobody really talks about this much anymore, but you might recall issues about panel stacking from a few years ago. We effectively eliminated that, and we have a much more transparent process with the precedential opinion panel now, but also standard operating procedures that tell the public precisely, you know, how, you know, what the PTAB does to assign judges to a case, and so on. You know, a couple of other rule changes that we have implemented along the way as well, with certain presumptions. So, you know, there's not a single, but we did a lot. And I do think the system is more balanced. But as I say, like, you know, balance is never, you can never say, okay, job done. I envision kids in a park playing on the playground, and there is the balance beam, right? The seesaw thing. You know, you have a kid on one side, a kid on the other side, and they go up and down. To be right in the middle, where the balance beam is perfectly balanced and both kids are equally above the ground, right, and they're in a steady state position, it's really hard to do, right? It's much easier to be, you know, to have one kid at the very top and the other one at the very bottom, and you're stationed there, or vice versa. And to be perfectly balanced, it's constant work, constant adjustments. And, you know, the PTO is, I'm certain, going to continuously look at all these issues, listen to the public, and continuously make adjustments as necessary to keep the system in balance.
As you were listing those changes to the PTAB, I was thinking, wow, that's a lot. And that's just the changes you were able to make to the PTAB. I guess on a conceptual level, for people who haven't served in government at a high level like yourself, can you talk a little bit about how patent policy develops in an administration? I guess, what is the impetus and how do you kind of push that through?
Yeah, so the PTO director actually has two jobs, right? And the title reflects that. So the title is, it's a lot of words, by the way, Undersecretary of Commerce for Intellectual Property and Director of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. So those are two, really, they really are two different jobs. As the Undersecretary for IP, you and therefore the office are responsible. You have the policy lead in the administration for all domestic and international policy issues. So that goes beyond patents and trademarks. Obviously, it includes patents and trademarks, but there's more. There's copyright policy, trade secret policy, IP issues as they relate to international trade, and policy that comes out of that. So the PTO has the lead, and the director have the lead in the administration on all those issues. But the PTO and the director are not the only agencies or folks with interests and a stake in the United States IP policy position. There are lots of others and other agencies. The USTR, for example, the US Trade Representative, right? The Department of State, the Department of Energy, the IPEC, the Intellectual Property Enforcement Coordinator within the White House complex, and I could go on. And so whenever a major policy position for the United States comes up, you know, we consult. The PTO has the lead on IP policy, but nevertheless, we consult with everybody, and we try to create consensus and go from there. And by the way, I don't want to leave out the Department of Justice. The DOJ has a huge stake in IP issues as well. So that's generally on policy, major policy positions. Now, within the PTO itself, as the director of the PTO itself and the operations of the PTO, there you're much more on your own, right? So if it's a specific issue that relates to the PTAB, you know, others might have an interest, but it's a lower level kind of thing. So you try to check with folks if you know they have an interest or if, you know, depending on the issue. But on the operational side of things, that's a more, to some extent, depending on the issue, a more insular type of an approach.
So that's interesting. So I guess like those changes you described to the PTAB, those really you had to kind of take the initiative and make the decision about what the correct path is. That's a lot of responsibility. I guess, you know, how do you navigate that? I guess, how do you decide, you know, who do you look to kind of for advice and for recommendations about what to do and about, you know, the implementation? How does that kind of?
Well, I'll tell you how I dealt with it, although I suspect every director is a little bit different. I believe in doing a lot of listening in general, working collaboratively, and this was whether I was in private practice as a lawyer working with clients or managing my law firm as the managing partner for 6 years, or in government. So first of all, I on any one of these major policy positions, I did a lot of talking internally at the PTO. The PTO is a remarkable organization, by the way, Eli. 13,000 people, extremely knowledgeable. The collective IP knowledge there is second to none anywhere in the world. So a lot of smart people with a lot of history on these issues. I would consult with them a lot, have a lot of internal discussions. I want to put people to know that they need to tell me their unvarnished opinions. I didn't want to be surrounded by people that just agreed with me. And I made that clear. If you disagree, I really want to hear from you, because that adds tremendous value. So there were a lot of discussions in a very collaborative fashion. But I also, it was very important to me to engage with the public and stakeholders. I had a lot of stakeholder meetings with individual companies or industry groups, coming to meet with us in different formations, and we would listen to them. And as you can imagine, in the IP system, there are a lot of views, right? You only have one patent system, but there is a whole spectrum of positions. So I tried to listen to anyone who wanted to be heard. So we took that into account. And depending on the issue, we would listen and talk a lot with other government agencies. On standard essential patents, for example, we spoke a lot with the antitrust division at the Department of Justice and with NIST, National Institute of Science, Standards and Technology. But that's just one example. So a lot of listening and then driving to some consensus and try to be as balanced as possible.
What advice would you give to, a company or an organization that wants to effectively communicate with a future USPTO director? What's the best way to do it? You know, hold the protest outside the USPTO, schedule a meeting. You know, what's from the other vantage point?
What do you think? Thankfully, I did not experience any protests outside the PTO. I think there was a protest.
It was before your time, yeah.
Yeah, that was before my time, exactly. So I don't have experience with that. But in all seriousness, I think if you have views on where the patent system or whatever IP issue should be, make yourself known. There are formal and informal ways to communicate. So sometimes, for example, there are formal requests for public comment from the agency. Every agency does this, but if on our issues, PTO would put out a request for formal comments, and they come in different shapes. But submit a comment. Believe me, the PTO reads all that stuff. I personally read the comments, but there's a formal process, and people read that information. It's really important. And you know, if you don't put a comment in, and you say, gee, I'm sure somebody else will put it in. Boy, don't be surprised at the end of the day if your view is not being considered because somebody else might not have put it in. So put your comments in when formal requests are made available. But also you can ask for a meeting. I took almost all those meetings. I don't know about other directors and what their view will be in the future. I think it's valuable. Look, I always thought, and I think it's categorically true for every public servant, we are there to serve the public. As far as I was concerned, I was there to serve the stakeholders in the IP community. So to do that, I want to know what the stakeholders want. And I want to hear all the views as much as possible. And then the hard job is to try to balance those. Because again, you have one patent system, for example. Yeah. So you need to take all that in and make a decision. But I personally was interested in hearing as much as possible from the public.
And you know, obviously, you know, there are time constraints being in DC. You're not going to be in the job probably forever. But how did you balance that? Because there's always people saying, all right, just wait till to hear more views, to see get more data, to kind of have more roundtables. How do you balance that with going ahead and taking action versus people just saying, no, maybe you're right, but let's just wait, you know?
Yeah, I was conscious from day one that I'm there for only a limited period of time. This is the way the American government works. I'm a big supporter of that. I think folks like myself who serve, we're there consciously. We know, we should know that we're there for a limited period of time. So you have to do your job with that constraint in mind. So, you know, if people say just wait a little bit longer, boy, that probably means we shouldn't do that thing at all. So I was very conscious of that. But as far as I was concerned, I wanted to be sure that we get things done, right? So to do that, you don't want to come in with too big of an agenda, because then you get nothing done. So from the beginning, I came in with three major things. And I spoke about them at my confirmation hearing and in early speeches and the like. And we did them. And then I told the team that we're going to focus on these three things. If we have time, we'll do more things. And we certainly did have time to do more things, quite a few more things. But we took it one step at a time. And I think we had the opportunity to get a lot of public input and do all sorts of studies. We put out a lot of reports from our chief economist. We put out a lot of requests for public comment. We received unprecedented numbers in some of those cases of public comments for the PTO, unprecedented for the PTO. We generate a lot of public interest, public views, which is great. So I think we had plenty of time to do the right studies and consider all the points of view.
Is there anything about, I guess, that surprised you about DC, how DC operated, or the USPTO after you became director, something that I guess you might have not known before?
Yeah, you know, I guess I probably in the back of my mind, I knew it before I came in, but nevertheless, it did surprise me every time and along the way about how many hoops you have to jump through to make any kind of a change with, you know, not just internally, right? So our own imposed hoops with meeting with as many people as possible, hearing as many points of view as possible, those things made sense. But then there's so many, you got to check with this entity and that entity and this agency and, you know, and that agency and submit this kind of a form and then that kind of a form. But it should not be surprising, right? It's a large federal bureaucracy, the U.S. government is. But really, almost every time it's like, really? We have to do this yet one more thing? Like, okay, let's just go do it.
You know, I came across an interview from when you were a managing partner of IRL, and you said, you talked about, you know, what made your firm great at the time. You said, to achieve excellence at every level, we begin by identifying and hiring some of the brightest lawyers in the nation. We train them intensely. We give them early responsibility, ownership, and autonomy. And obviously, the USPTO is a very different organization. But did you kind of form any kind of view about what makes employees, but I'm particularly thinking of patent examiners, successful at the USPTO?
I think those, what you read from my prior interview when I was the managing partner of a law firm, those traits translate to not just the PTO, but in general, to a group of highly successful, highly educated professionals. You know, you take smart people who have been and want to be, continue to be successful, and you put them together in a work environment. You want to give them the autonomy to succeed. And you want to continuously put them in a position to create, to be creative, to have the freedom to operate and express their creativity, their intelligence, their skills, and for everybody in that collective to learn from everybody else. That is what makes a group successful, I think. And I think that translates. Now, obviously, the PTO is a very different organization from a law firm, right? First of all, it's much bigger with 13,000 people. It's more hierarchical than a law firm partnership, but just the general traits of success, I think translate. And I think at the PTO when I was there, I used the same approach and mentality with our management team. I wanted to hear their unvarnished views, to be creative, and to have an open discussion in a very professional, collegial way to bring out the best idea, to vet them, to discuss them, and ultimately to create consensus and settle on the best approach.
You wrote a note, I guess as your quote-unquote USPTO resignation letter, and you mentioned this book, The Boys on the Boat. I was just wondering, is there any particular reason why that book resonated with you? And I guess what made you think of it when you were writing that letter?
It's one of my favorite books. And it seems like you've read it, Eli, since I see it there. it really is teaches us about how to succeed at whatever you are doing, and there are no shortcuts. You know, you can be as smart as anyone else. You can be as creative as anyone else, but there is no shortcut to hard work, to persistence, to dedication, and ultimately to being all in. I don't have the exact quote in front of me right now, but I believe the quote I referenced in my farewell message dealt with being all in. And the fact that at the end of a race, and these boys were stepping out of the boat, in order for them to be successful, they had to feel as if they've left a piece of themselves in the boat forever. In other words, they gave it their all. So to me, that's very meaningful to anything we do, whether we're patent lawyers, whether we are public servants, whether we are parents to our children. Just to do well and be happy, you have to give it all.
Great advice. So I looked it up, and Romania does have its own patent office. It's called the State Office for Inventions and Trademarks. Have you ever had a chance to speak to the head of that office?
Yeah, I did. I visited Romania about a year and a half ago, I think, before the pandemic. I visited with the head of the office back then and other government officials, and I gave a speech there. I gave actually two speeches in Bucharest. It was a very fun trip.
I guess that must be a great experience for them as well. So, I guess my final question is, and I think you touched upon it, but I guess if you have any other advice, what advice would you give to a younger patent attorney, or let's say a managing partner at a prominent patent litigation boutique out there who wants to become the next Andre Iancu?
Oh, boy, I don't know, Eli, that anybody wants to be the next Andre Iancu. It comes with a whole package of pros and cons. So, you know, folks should really want to be the best version of themselves that they can be. But look, I think for patent practitioners, IP practitioners, we are so lucky to be in this field. This is really, I mean, I guess I'm a little bit biased, but frankly, I think I'm objective as well. This is really like the best area of law to be in, one of the best professions to be in general. How lucky we are. We work on behalf of the most creative people in the world, literally people who are changing the world and improving the human condition. We are working with the future right before us come the inventions that most of the people will see in a few years from now. And by the way, along the way, they're paying us for that. I mean, it's unbelievable. We should be paying them for the privilege to be in this profession, and the fun we can have, we all have with it. So I hope that anybody who's in this profession, obviously every day there are challenges and things come up, but boy, you know, just step back a little bit and look at the grand scheme of things and really enjoy what we do and the great value we add to society and the economy. So my advice is really at a high level, really enjoy what you do and be thankful for the privilege we have to be in this profession.
That's great advice. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. It's been an honor to be with you.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. Or if you'd like to learn more about my firm, visit heritylp.com.